Hello and welcome to episode 210 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Perrin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the fast attack submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 at Pearl Harbor, and many other assignments and postings. How are you this morning, Bill?
I'm doing great. The weather's warmed up here in Florida. I thought I was in Maine for a while, and it's a bright, sunny day.
It was rather nippy. It was ironic that we're recording this in March. Today's the 21st. Yesterday was the 20th, and yesterday was the coldest day that we've had all winter.
Yes, I'm here in Florida. Yeah. Incredible.
It was incredible. Yeah, for this late. But such as it is, living in the Deep South, if you don't like the weather, as I say, wait 5 minutes and it'll change. Well, this week we're going to talk about an interesting engagement, shall we say. Allied forces executed their first post-Guadalcanal-Solomons area offensive when soldiers of the U.S. Army, as well as U.S. Marines and Fiji Nationals, landed on Rendova on June 30, 1943, and New Georgia on July 2, 1943. The goal of the New Georgia campaign was to secure the newly constructed Japanese airfield at Munda on the southwestern corner of New Georgia. Initial advances on New Georgia from Zenana towards Munda were slow at best. The Green National Guardsmen of the 43rd Infantry Division were finding life against both the jungle and the Japanese to be, shall we say, difficult. In order to strengthen the American advance and to theoretically cut off Japanese resupply and reinforcement lanes in the Zenana-Munda area, the Americans landed another amphibious force at Rice Anchorage. Japanese keenly aware that the loss of Munda and its precious airfield would put Bougainville and Rabaul under direct Allied air threat, were in no hurry to lose that territory. As such, the Japanese resorted to their method of reinforcing garrisons via fast destroyers and planned for such a mission to be executed on the night of July 6, 1943. The so-called Tokyo Express would run again in the Solomons, this time to New Georgia. Armed with the actionable intel that the Japanese were coming down the slot in a force of destroyers laden with troops, the U.S. Navy deployed a cruiser task force to intercept the Japanese and stop the infamous Tokyo Express at a little place called Kula Gulf. So, Bill, this is a naval battle, a gun battle, straight up, that is not really well known. It's something that's not really talked about, and it's kind of interesting because it does play a large hand in the events that follow, as all things do. But this one specifically, you know, there's a series of actions, and we'll talk about those in future episodes. But there were some events that kind of set up Kula Gulf here. You know, there were some things that happened at Rice Anchorage the night before. Really, let's talk about some of those things. What happened out there?
Yeah, just to provide some context, we tried this last week for the first time. It seemed to go okay. So what I'm going to do is try to set the scene a little bit with the map. And so hopefully, Seth, you're seeing my map here. I'm going to refer again with my cursor to a few key areas just to remind people what we're talking about here. So, of course, Guadalcanal down at the bottom right of this map. And what the Allied forces are essentially doing is marching up this chain of islands. And, of course, everybody's now familiar with the slot, which is the little channel between, let's say, New Britain and the various island chains that the Japanese used to try to mask their movement as they were trying to reinforce Guadalcanal first, and now they're reinforcing the New Georgia Islands here. Again, for context, Rabaul is way up here in New Britain, and this is Bougainville. We'll be talking about that in future episodes as well. And of course, Buna over here in New Guinea, we've already talked about that, and the road to Port Moresby over the mountains that didn't go so well. So that provides a little bit of context. Now, zooming in on New Georgia, there's these two gulfs here. Here's New Georgia proper. We've talked about Rendova right here, and we're going to talk a lot about Kolombangara here. And then here's the Kula Gulf, and above that, the Vela Gulf. Now, the Vela Gulf is coming. Stay tuned for that. But it's interesting that as we were trying to establish places to operate from in New Georgia, in and around New Georgia, that we kind of encountered the Japanese and marched up these gulfs northwestward. And so what's happening here, again, we're trying to reinforce landing forces in New Georgia to build a field, an airfield at Munda here. And this bay here is where a lot of the action's going to take place in the Kula Gulf. Right, Seth?
Correct. Yeah, there's a lot of shooting that goes down right here. And it actually all starts the night before the Battle of Kula Gulf. So as we talked about in our last episode, you know, the Marines and some infantry from the United States Army was landed at a place called Rice Anchorage. That's up on the top left corner there of New Georgia, yeah. Right there.
And here I got it up again. And so it's right in here between Kula Magara on the way to, you know, in Augie Point, we talked about that before. And so right in here is Rice Anchorage. Now, again, last week I pointed out all this shoal water, and I apologize to listeners, the audio podcast listeners, that you're not being able to see that. But these shoal waters are going to play a substantial role in the course of events that's coming up. And of course, here's the landing zone at Kula Magara, where the Japanese are fairly firmly entrenched. And like I said last week, these distances are not significant. So this is within artillery range between Rendova and Munda Point here, and between Kula Magara and Rice Anchorage here. So this is well within artillery range, and that's going to play a factor because you're never out of the range of enemy fire when you're landing on these spots.
So following the landings at Rice Anchorage, the Navy, the United States Navy, obviously, sailed into the waters near Avila on Kula Magara. This is in between those two islands that Bill was talking about right there in the Kula Gulf. And they opened fire on shore installations there. This is to suppress the fire that was being brought into the Marines and the Army's area right there at Rice Anchorage. Given the Japanese a little taste, these are United States Navy's destroyers that are going in there and shooting up these Japanese shore positions. It's given the Japanese a little taste of what the Marines suffered through on Guadalcanal, you know, all the time from Japanese destroyers and cruisers as they came and shelled the positions there on Guadalcanal back in 42. Rear Admiral Walden Ainsworth was in command of this little task force 36.1. And these are the guys that laid fire in the Kula Magara and Bairoko for about over 2 hours. They were out there for quite a while, throwing a lot of lead at these Japanese positions. At the same time as this is occurring, two U.S. Navy destroyers, the USS Strong and the USS Chevalier, also entered Bairoko Harbor to render gunfire support and deter immediate Japanese response to the Rice Anchorage landings. Strong and Chevalier entered Bairoko Harbor at about 30 minutes after midnight and opened fire. The destroyer bombardment only lasted about 10 minutes and, frankly, honestly, was a waste of ammunition. It really didn't do jack squat. But what it did do is attract the attention of Japanese destroyers. There was a Japanese landing force that was coming in via sea from Rabaul to land more troops in the Rice Anchor, not the Rice Anchorage area, in the Bairoko area and the Kula Magara area. And their trip was, you know, rudely interrupted by these U.S. Navy destroyers shelling the positions. It was realized pretty quickly that the Japanese probably weren't going to be able to get in there and drop their troops off unmolested. As the small force of American destroyers Strong and Chevalier leave the area, USS Strong is struck by a single torpedo, just one torpedo, boom, just lands in there and detonates on the after end of the torpedo. According to crewmen on the Strong, the torpedo seemingly came out of nowhere. It was assumed that it was fired by a Japanese submarine because there were no targets in sight, no surface targets in sight on anybody's radar. In actuality, the torpedo that hit USS Strong was fired by the Japanese destroyer Niizuki. Niizuki fired a full spread of long lances at these two American destroyers that were firing on the beach. And get this, these long lances that we've talked about ad nauseum through almost all of these episodes that we've done on any kind of naval fight, it's known that these things had a very, very long range. How long? I'll tell you. 11 nautical miles is what the estimated distance is that Izuki fired this spread of torpedoes that hit USS Strong. The kill shot is believed to be the longest range torpedo shot in naval history, period. That is an incredible distance, right, Bill?
It is. And, you know, again, I'm showing the map here because it's impressive, but understandable both at the same time, because I talked about these shoal waters. These are reefs off of New Georgia, off of Rice Anchorage here. And so the only way our destroyers could get in and out of these areas around Rice Anchorage and Bairoku was to skirt these reefs. Now, if you're firing a spread of long lance torpedoes, what do you want to do? You don't want those torpedoes to strike the reefs, so you can fire those torpedoes into the openings in the reefs, which happen to be the only way the destroyers can get in and out. So for some context here, 11 nautical miles is up here in the vicinity of Kolombangara. So if you were a Japanese destroyer up here and you were precise in your aim point and you knew you could get the course of the torpedoes right, all you really need to do is get one into the opening of this reef near Rice Anchorage at the time one of the American destroyers is coming out, and you're going to get a hit. Basically, it's a funnel. It's a funnel that's going to, you know, direct to where the American combatants can go, and it's a funnel that's going to direct to where the long lance torpedoes can go. And so the only question at that point is, do you have the range? And these long lance torpedoes certainly did have the range. So yeah, it was a record-breaking long-range shot, but they had a little bit of help.
They did, but it's still, that is
still impressive.
We wished we could have thrown a torpedo that long and hit something. It's an incredible, incredible shot. So USS Strong takes this single torpedo. She just took the one, but you got to remember this is a DD that took this shot here. She immediately begins to list, settling by the stern. Strong's sister, which is hard to say, Strong's sister, the Chevalier, intentionally, and this is pretty cool here, though, she intentionally rammed the Strong in the bow so as to allow nets to be thrown over from the Strong to the Chevalier so Strong's crew could get off. It was readily apparent that Strong was going to go down. She had, you know, long lances, as we all know, packed a wallop, and this thing really eviscerated the stern of this destroyer and just really, really put a lick on it. But the fact that Chevalier went in there and purposely rammed into the side of Strong so as to get these crewmen off is a testament, A, to the survivability of the USS Chevalier, which is a Fletcher-class destroyer, and the competence of the helmsman and the skipper of Chevalier to know that they can get in there and then eventually get their ship out of there. It takes a lot of cojones.
And yeah, it's a gutsy move because remember, they thought this torpedo was fired by a submarine. So They think there's a submarine still out there, and you tie your ship up to a sinking ship, you're not going to maneuver. You are a sitting duck for whatever that submarine is. So it's the less brave thing to do would have been tell the crew, of the Strong to get in the water. We're going to pick you up when we can. But no, these guys said, we're going to get these guys as quickly as we can, which means, you know, get them across the cargo net on board and then get the heck out of there. And that's what they elected to do.
So in the action that occurs here, they get 241 guys off of Strong by just climbing hand over fist over the nets. And, you know, obviously some guys are going in the water and they're being plucked out of the water too. As the two ships are linked, and they are physically linked at this point, Japanese shore gunners, of course, illuminate both of the ships and start attempting to rake them with fire from shore positions. As the Japanese are firing at these two destroyers, another destroyer, the USS O'Bannon, which is a very heroic ship. You're going to hear a lot about O'Bannon as we continue to go through the Solomon's campaign and the rest of the Pacific War, frankly. O'Bannon pulls into the harbor and returns fire at the shore batteries. So what O'Bannon does is basically put herself in between the Japanese shore batteries and the two American destroyers that are basically, you know, tied up together right there. O'Bannon positioned herself and immediately starts to open fire with her main battery of 5-inch guns and just starts pumping lead into the shore batteries here. O'Bannon, really, the captain of the O'Bannon, whom I'm drawing a complete blank right now as to the skipper's name, which I should know because I just read it yesterday, but forgive me for that. But I mean, he's another one that put himself and his vessel at risk to save the lives of fellow crewmen here. And I mean, this is, again, bravery of the highest order right here, Bill.
Mm-hmm. It is indeed. Now, you notice that we're talking about just destroyers at this point. Didn't Nimitz have something to do with the fact that we're only operating destroyers in and around New Georgia at this point in the war?
He does indeed have a finger in this pie. Obviously, he has a finger in all pies when it comes to the Pacific War here, especially in this area. But yeah, as we're going to see as this battle develops, there's a reason that Nimitz just kind of puts the kibosh on putting a lot of cruisers into the waters here. Because if you look at that map that Bill had showed, and he'll show again here in a minute, we're talking narrow waters here. You know, these are waters probably that are frankly a little bit narrower than, you know, than Savo, the, you know, Iron Bottom Sound area here that we were talking about at Guadalcanal. So, I mean, there's not a lot of room for maneuver here. And we're going to see exactly why Nimitz does what he does here in just a few. Getting back to the Chevalier. Go ahead.
See, because remember the big famous battle of Savo Island. This is Savo Island. And you could see this water between, you know, Tulagi and Guadalcanal. While that is very constrained, this little tiny gap here north of New Georgia, that's what we're talking about here. So this was tight for cruisers. And what we're talking about here is a tiny body of water, way too tight for those cruisers. Now, it also needs to be said that by this point in the war, we don't have many cruisers left. Most of them have had the bejesus beat out of them, right? And their, you know, bows blown off, you know, sucked up torpedoes. And so there weren't a lot of cruisers available in the first place. But even if there were, Nimitz had already concluded that in this vicinity around New Georgia, the water just wasn't enough sea room to steam these cruisers. So, yeah, you're going to hear a lot about destroyers in these next couple of episodes.
This is a destroyer war. As I like to say, it's tighter than two coats of paint in that general area right there. So as Chevalier is backing away, she does obviously extricate herself from her sister ship. As she's backing away, the Strong is sinking rapidly. Strong was essentially being held afloat by her sister. And as soon as Chevalier backs away, Strong goes down. Several men were still aboard and went into the water as the destroyer sank. And this is an unfortunate episode here. And this happens a lot when destroyers go down if their depth charges are not set on safety. And Strong's were not. When the DD goes down, those depth charges are still aboard. What are they going to do? They're going to do what depth charges do. They're going to go kaboom at their prescribed depth. And if there's men in the water, that's a big, you know, that's a big issue. And that's exactly what happens here. The depth charges go off. A lot of the guys that are in the water that were survivors from the Strong's episode here are critically wounded. I knew a guy that was on the USS Hammond that was tied up next to Yorktown at Midway, and the same thing happened to her. And he said it was basically, it's like having the largest enema of your life, because these depth charges are just forcing everything upwards and it's got to go somewhere. So that happens to a lot of guys here in the water as they survived the sinking of Strong only to be critically wounded by Strong's own depth charges.
The same Hammond that was split in two by a torpedo, right? As she's trying to rescue Yorktown sailors. Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other destroyers in the area, Ralph Talbot and Gwen, pull what guys they can out of the water. And together, the four American destroyers get the hell out of Bairoko Harbor because they're still under fire. O'Bannon's laying fire in on the shore targets, but they're firing blindly, really, into the dark. And these four American destroyers get out of here. So this is kind of an inauspicious beginning to the events that are going to transpire over the next 24 hours. Right, Bill?
No, and you're going to hear Ralph Talbot's name over and over and over again throughout this war. There's a large number of destroyers that perform heroically until 1945, until the war end. And this is one of those things that is going to be, remember that name.
Oh, yeah. So the guy I mentioned before, just briefly, commanding 36.1, is a guy named Rear Admiral Walden Ainsworth. Now, this is a guy we have not spoken about ever that I can recall, Bill, that ever before on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about him. He's like all guys of his rank, stature at this time in the war. He's a Naval Academy graduate. Who is Ainsworth? Who was he?
Yeah, he was, among his first actions was leading one of the battalions that landed at Veracruz from the battleship Florida. He spent some time at sea during World War I, never really seeing any action. Parenthetically, I was XO of the SSBN Florida that was named after that battleship many decades later. During the interwar period, he did time at the armor and projectile station plant in Charleston, West Virginia, before serving on a variety of cruisers and destroyers. At one time, he held the position of gunnery officer on the staff of Commodore Destroyer Squadrons, and eventually taught navigation at my alma mater, the Naval Academy, again, several decades before I was there.
He's a pretty interesting dude, and he carves himself out a nice little career here at the early part of World War II in the Pacific. He spent some time aboard battleships and cruisers too, and if you listen to his career path, what Bill just laid out and what I'm about to spit out, it sounds very much like Admiral Willis Lee. It really does, and they're not far off in terms of what they studied, what they were proponents of. They do have some obviously different career trajectories as things go on here. But Ainsworth spent time aboard battleships and cruisers in the late 30s and immediate pre-war era. He served as the executive officer of BB-41 USS Mississippi in 1936. And kind of an odd thing, I'm not saying it never happened, but this is kind of unique in that the XO eventually returns to take command of the ship. He takes command of USS Mississippi on December 20th, 1941. So the former XO returning to his ship, taking command.
It is unusual.
It's kind of strange, right?
Yeah. I don't know of many times when that's happened. Of course, it's commonplace in aviation squadrons where the XO fleets up to be the skipper, but aboard ship, very unusual.
Yeah,
in those days.
I kind of think he was put aboard Mississippi to take her for a ride, because Mississippi was on the East Coast. She was in the Atlantic at this time, and she had to get to the Pacific. And I believe that Ainsworth also had to get to the Pacific. So they looked for, like, what's the first place I can stick this dude? Here.
I actually don't think he was skipper for very long, because I think he was selected for flag very quickly and got promoted to Commander Destroyer's Pacific Fleet. And until he took the role of Commander Cruiser Division 5, was it? Or
nine. And you're 100% right. He gets out to the Pacific War, and he's a guy that is well thought of. You know, he's a gunnery guy. He's a cruiser guy. He's a destroyer guy, which this is, as we know at this point, yes, it's a carrier war, but right now in this neck of the woods, this is a surface ship war. This is cruiser destroyer action, and this is the cat that they need in the theater at this point. Admiral Halsey assigns Ainsworth as Commander Task Force 67. This is after all this occurs. This is the same unit that got the piss beat out of it at Tassafaronga. You'll remember our brief snippet on Tassafaronga, where, you know, it was a debacle from the get-go, and Halsey immediately jerks the commander out of there and sticks Ainsworth in command.
Carlton Wright, exactly. We talked about that during our Tassafaronga episode, where we said this is one and only time we'll probably be talking about Carlton Wright.
Mm-hmm. And so far that holds true. Well, I guess you could say this is the second time, right? But Ainsworth takes over the defeated force that was, well, what was left after Tassafaronga, and he immediately starts building it into a strong fighting force. And they're just beating the Japanese wherever they can lay their hands on them in that Guadalcanal area. This is, you know, January 43. This is after really the main naval actions. But still, regardless of this, he's carving out a nice little path here for himself. He earns his group's, his actions earn his group's the nickname the Ainsworth Express, because they're always at sea, seemingly, and are always running into some sort of Japanese opposition, and they're always seemingly destroying that opposition, or at the very least causing them to flee. So I mean, he's definitely,
remember, Yeah, Seth, remember that the Japanese ships that steam up and down the slot are referred to as the Tokyo Express. So now we got an American strike group that's steaming up and down the slot. So it's kind of natural that it would be named the Ainsworth Express if it's succeeding.
Right. Right. And it is. It is. He's making it, you know, like I said, he's making a nice little carve out for himself in the career field here in the surface fleet of the U.S. Navy in the Solomon Islands. He's successful. He's inspired confidence among his crews, among the ships underneath him. And he is definitely a guy that Halsey believes is going to carry the war to the Japanese as we're progressing up the Solomon's chain. Hence the reason he's picked for this specific event. Let's get into the fight here at Kula Gulf, because it doesn't necessarily last long, but it has some pretty interesting stories that wound up coming out of this thing. So Ainsworth's task force for the upcoming battle is a strong cruiser and destroyer force. It consists of USS Helena, whom we've talked about many, many times, her sister Honolulu, Helena's other sister USS St. Louis. It also has the destroyers Nicholas, O'Bannon that we just mentioned, Radford, and Jenkins. These are all Fletcher class DDs, and these are all cruisers of the same class as well. These, if you were to recall, the Helena class, well, not Helena class, but cruisers of this ilk are the very rapid firing 6-inch gun triple turret cruisers that are triple gun cruisers that can just lay a tremendous amount of lead on an enemy target within seconds, seemingly.
These are the machine gun cruisers?
These are the machine gun cruisers, yes. And this is not a name, so just so everybody knows, this is not a name that we bestowed on this thing. This is what the Japanese called these bad boys, is machine gun cruisers. Following their bombardment of the Kolombangara area, Ainsworth and his task force moved towards the area of the Coral Sea to resupply with ammunition, fuel, and the like. On the afternoon of July the 5th, Ainsworth receives a message from Admiral Halsey instructing him to return to the New Georgia area, Kula Gulf specifically. The reason for this is to intercept a Japanese troop convoy that was known to be heading to the area. Now, this is an ultra break. This is also an aerial recon discovery that we find here. And it's clearly the Japanese are bringing people down to the New Georgia area to reinforce their defensive positions there. And this is not something that we want to allow to happen, right?
No, not at all. Yeah, he's racing to the south here. Again, I'll pull up the map. This Coral Sea down here. By the way, good diving in the Coral Sea. I've done that before. And then racing back up right over here to the Kula Gulf to engage the Japanese that we know or have been told are on their way.
Yeah. Ainsworth had not been briefed on exactly what he may run into. They just, the aerial reconnaissance, which was usually very, very good. And again, they did spot the Japanese coming down. They just said, there's a troop convoy coming. Well, what the hell does that consist of? You know, it could be destroyers, could be battleships. They don't know. So
and barges.
Exactly.
At one point, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We'll see a lot of barges here in the near future. And they were being used at this time as well. But, you know, he had two plans of action in mind. And this goes back to the point of A, he's already combat experienced, and B, he knew somewhat of the Japanese tactics, so he knew what he wanted to do and he knew what worked. If the enemy was encountered at a medium range, and his definition of medium range is 8 to 10,000 yards, he planned to execute a full radar control gunfire fight, allowing his rapid firing light cruisers, this is the machine gun cruisers, as we talked about, to utilize their main batteries at a blinding speed to literally smother the Japanese before they ever even knew what happened to them. If the enemy was encountered at long range, he would illuminate with star shells and walk the fire into his targets. Sounds like a good plan. It sounds like it might work. It's proved radar control gunfire, you know, Willis Lee. It's proved that it does work when it's executed at the proper time and the proper distance. Ainsworth's task force enters the area around midnight on July the 6th, having bent 29 knots in a furious run through the slot to get to the assigned area. As the ships entered the Kula Gulf, they went to GQ and dispersed into an anti-aircraft circular formation as the night was clear with a moonless sky. So he's worried, Ainsworth at this point is worried about being discovered by Japanese snoopers, which there were quite a few, because, I mean, as you showed in the map, they're, we're close to Rabaul now, so it's a hop, skip, and a jump for Japanese aerial recon to get down there and just, you know, have prying eyes into basically anything we want to do because it's so close. Go ahead, Bill.
Now, there's the old saying that no plan survives contact with the enemy. And that saying is about to be reinforced here in a minute.
Big time. Big time. The enemy force that Ainsworth was waiting for had left Bowen bound for Vila on New Georgia to land infantry reinforcements, as we were talking about. The Japanese force was under the command of Admiral Toruo Ikiyama and consisted of 10 ships in all, broken into three separate groups carrying some 2,600 Japanese soldiers. All of the Japanese, quote, transports were fast destroyers, typical of the Japanese nocturnal reinforcement efforts that had been made really at towards the tail end of the Japanese experience on Guadalcanal, and almost exclusively with the exception of the few barges that come in and out of here in the New Georgia area. So they're using their DDs to get in there, drop troops off, and get the hell out of there as fast as they possibly can. So if you've got 10 destroyers on the enemy side, and you've got the DDs that we talked about on the U.S. side, plus three rapid-firing 6-inch gun light cruisers, you would think that the gunpowder advantage lays on the American side, right, Bill? But does it?
Well, it does if you have the right kind of if your radars are working as planned and there's no interference with the radars, and you have the element of surprise, you're gonna prevail here. But there's some difficulties that we're just going to discover as we go forward. And one of those difficulties is something called ground clutter. Now, if you're in the open ocean and your radar has nothing to reflect but the target ships, it's one thing. But when you're in this gulf between a bunch of land, the radar sees that land. And the reflection from that land generates this feature called ground clutter, which can actually mask any shipping between your radar and that land. And that's going to be one factor here that I'm not sure they were prepared for.
No. Well, there's certainly not that. And there was also something, and this blows my mind, that something else that they were not prepared for. And by they, I mean Admiral Ainsworth specifically. Now, these are, as you will recall, I said 10 Japanese destroyers. What do Japanese destroyers do? They launch torpedoes. They're torpedo boats. Ainsworth, and I can't get this, man, and I looked into numerous sources to see if this was actually true, but it is true. Ainsworth was unaware of the existence of Japanese long lance torpedoes. Had no clue that these things existed.
To be clear, he knew they had torpedoes. It was these
for sure
super powerful, really long range. Even after the Strong had been hit by a long lance, nobody, there's this thing that we talk about in the military. It's a lack of a questioning attitude, you know, and experienced military commander ought to say, holy cow, where'd that come from? Okay. Maybe he accepted the notion that it was fired by a submarine that was in close. Then you can kind of believe that he didn't realize that a torpedo could be fired at 11 nautical miles and hit a target, which was only a long lance could do. But you've got to wonder where his head was and why there was this lack of a questioning attitude that would have really helped to inform the decisions he's making as he approaches battle here.
Yeah, big time. And you can also lay the blame on the U.S. Navy and the area, too, as a whole, because there were plenty of task force commanders who were all too familiar with the Japanese long lance. And that information was not disseminated to Ainsworth. And I'm like, what? How do you not know that the greatest ship killer in the Solomon Islands doesn't exist? And again, to your point, yeah, he knew the Japanese had torpedoes, duh. But he was unaware of the range, the speed, and the power of these long lance torpedoes. So despite the fact that the U.S. Navy task force had an overwhelming gunpowder or gunfire, you know, ability advantage over the Japanese advantage, thank you, the Japanese more than equalized it with their massive amount of torpedoes that they're having on these destroyers.
Well, the other aspect of it is the Japanese tendency, their doctrine, which is fire the torpedoes, wait until the clock says the torpedoes are about to hit. and you know, hopefully get a couple of torpedo hits before you open fire with the guns, thereby retaining the element of surprise until the last possible moment before you, you know, make it known that you're there. He seemed to have been unaware of that tactic as well, because that's exactly what the Japanese are going to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and a part of it too is I think, you know, as I said before, you know, he was unaware of what the composition of the Japanese force was. And while we had a very, very strong aerial presence in the area, and that's undeniable, for whatever reason, and I'll tell you the reason, but we were not able to consistently track this convoy via air. There was bad weather in between the Japanese run to the Kula Gulf. And frankly, the aerial reconnaissance just flat out lost them and could not pick them up again. The Japanese force that would usually theoretically have been attacked by strafing B-25s and A-20s wasn't, because they couldn't find them. They knew they were out there, but they couldn't lay eyes on these people to direct an airstrike incoming inbound. Therefore, these Japanese are coming in the area, and Ainsworth doesn't know what he's running into, number one. Number two, he doesn't know exactly how many. He doesn't know exactly where they're coming from, but he still has a good plan, or so he thinks. The Japanese entered the Gulf area at about 26 minutes after midnight, 0026, when Akiyama detached one transport group to head to the southeastern shore of Kolomengara and head towards Vila. The seven remaining Japanese ships remained in column at 21 knots before Akiyama detached another group at 0118, leaving only three destroyers: Niizuki, that's Strong's long lance, long range slayer, and Suzukaze and Tenakaze heading north. These three destroyers are basically acting, well, they're not basically, they're acting as a defense group. They're on the prowl for anything that might be in the waters at this time, while the other Japanese destroyers are off busy landing their troops. Unbeknownst to Akiyama, Ainsworth's radar had picked the column up at 0140 and were beginning the plot at 24,700 yards. So the Americans knew that, hey, we got, you know, there's bad guys in the area. Ainsworth opened up on the TBS and instructed his ships to form into a battle column. And this is important, because you're going to hear this, and in our next episode, when we talk about Vela Gulf and Kolomengara naval battles, you're going to hear this again and what we do differently, how we learn from this event here. The battle column is such: it's destroyers Nicholas and O'Bannon in the lead, followed by Honolulu, Helena, St. Louis, Jenkins, and Radford. So basically, it's the standard U.S. Navy straight line column of surface warships. There is no detachment of destroyers here to allow them to do their thing. The destroyers are tethered to the cruisers, basically acting as a screening force for these cruisers, and not really being utilized to their full advantage.
The way destroyers are supposed to be used. And at this point in the war, we knew what the destroyer's advantage was. And again, this is one of those other things where we say, what was Ainsworth thinking?
Yeah. This is not his shining moment. I'll say that. At 0142, the Americans changed course to close the range between themselves and the targets. Yet, despite the advantage of having radar, and this is what you were talking about earlier, Bill, Japanese destroyer Niizuki also had radar, by the way. It was rudimentary and it wasn't very good, but they had it. The Japanese were working on the radar technology. The radar picture that Ainsworth was looking at was massively confusing. And this is, again, exactly to what you were talking about earlier, with ground clutter and all kinds of different things going on in the area at the same damn time. Radar scopes showed the Japanese formation splitting into several groups of unknown composition and course. To add to the confusion, Kolomengara itself, with its towering slopes, added to the clutter on the radar screens, further making the picture almost unviewable. You couldn't figure out what in God's green earth is going on these radar screens. And Bill, this is exactly to your point. And this is also when you're operating in an area that's about as wide as your driveway, and you're trying to move, you know, large naval vessels through it, you're going to get all kinds of reactions on your radar screens, right?
Yeah. And this is, again, whether you could, I would blame it on lack of proper training, because if they understood that they were going to lose these enemy combatants in the ground clutter at a certain geometry and a certain range from Kolomengara, the only way you can learn how those things happen is if you train in similar circumstances with islands in the background and things like that. If he understood the technology better, and I would propose the way Admiral Lee probably would have understood the technology, but Admiral Ainsworth did not. He would have realized that he needed to engage the targets and should have engaged them with torpedoes first, but then guns, before he lost them in the ground clutter. And he did not do that, and seems to have been surprised that the radar picture became so confused when the ships got between him and Cola Maguire.
Yep. So he's to exactly to your point here, though, he's losing precious minutes. You know, the time is literally bleeding away, waiting on the radar picture to clarify itself. He's basically got his, well, he doesn't basically, he's got his radar men staring at the screen going, come on, you know, show me what I need to know. He had to hold fire when he knew the enemy was out there, because the radar picture was not showing itself to be what he needed it to be because of the tight confines of the area. This is why we're talking about Nimitz and his cruiser decision here later on in just a few minutes. Finally, as they're clearing the area and starting to move into a little bit open, more of an open space, his radar picture finally tells him that the enemy force had broken into two groups that he could see. There was actually three, but regardless, he can see two now. And that the range had close to 11,000 yards. So this is the medium range that he was talking about, 8 to 11,000 yards. Deciding on plan A, this is the radar-controlled gunfire, he ordered Nicholas and O'Bannon to open fire on the closer group of Japanese ships, while the main U.S. column of cruisers and destroyers, Jenkins and Radford, opened up on the farther force. So again, this is, to your point earlier, Bill, this is negating the ability of the destroyers to launch a surprise attack, the American destroyers, on targets that they knew were there, were going to open fire with gunfire first, which is kind of bass ackwards, as they say, in the way that things should be done in this close confines. When you've got torpedo slinging destroyers, you want to utilize them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and then you know, the problem is, of course, the enemy reacts. So,
yes, they do.
You know, whether it was because they needed a turn to land the forces and land the reinforcements, or because they were reacting to the gunfire that was now visible, and you know, the enemy maneuvers, it changes course. And so then Ainsworth says, okay, now cease fire until we figure out what they're going to do, where they're going to go. So he tells the destroyers to hold their fire at this point, right after he orders open fire.
Mm-hmm. And they're holding it for a full 2 minutes. And while 2 minutes doesn't sound like a long time, that is an eternity when you've got ships moving at, you know, between 25 and 30 knots that are, you know, close to each other. They're 8 to 10,000 yards apart. They're close. That is an eternity. When he actually does order open fire again and basically just cut loose, Helena is the first one that does so. Now, if you will recall what we talked about at the very beginning of this episode, these cruisers, these same cruisers, Helena, St. Louis, and Honolulu, had performed a shore bombardment the night before. Helena had utilized all of her flashless powder the night before. The only thing that she had, and this is important because the only thing that she has aboard right now for her main batteries is the non-flashless powder. So when she opens fire, it looks like, you know, noon on a desert when she opens fire with her main batteries, letting everyone in the area know there is a ship right here and I am shooting at you.
Yeah, you probably have seen videos of nighttime, you know, gunfire, naval gunfire with non-flashless as a double negative. Just think of that being big flash every time. And so that, you know, it's dark and the gun goes off and suddenly it's daylight. And then the gun goes off again, suddenly it's daylight. That's what's happening here. It is impossible to miss the fact that there is a cruiser with a whole bunch of guns on it firing at me right now. So then that becomes the target.
Yep. Ainsworth thought he had the element of surprise, and he should have, frankly. What he was not under the realization was that the Japanese had actually been tracking him for quite a while. They knew he was there. Again, they didn't know the composition of the force. It didn't matter. They knew that Ainsworth was in the area, and they already had 16 fish in the water long before Ainsworth ever gives the order to cut loose. These long lances are in the water.
Yeah, with those super, super secret torpedoes that the battle group commander has no awareness they even exist. And, you know, just one of those things, the Japanese are doing it exactly the way it's supposed to be done. I think they detected them visually rather than by radar. Again, remember, they've got better night visual detection capabilities because they select their night lookout specifically for their night vision capability. And so everything at this point, the pendulum has swung to the Japanese favor at this point in the battle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. However, the one thing that we do, even though the fish are in the water, Ainsworth has no clue that the fish are in the water. The one thing that we do have on our side is the gunpowder, gunfire that we were talking about before. The first American salvo from the cruisers is aimed at the destroyer Nizuki. This is the same one that sunk Strong the night before. And they absolutely blanket her with 6-inch gunfire. Within seconds, Niizuki's steering gear is gone. Her hull was holed multiple times, and she swerved out of formation of fire. So the 6-inch gunfire from Honolulu, St. Louis, and Helena does exactly what it's designed to do, and they just pound this destroyer within seconds. I'm talking within, you know, under 30 seconds. They just absolutely smothered this thing. So, you know, the initial American salvos are like, whoa, you know, I mean, yeah, we're doing our job here. Definitely laying a lick on the Japanese. In tactics and decisions all too similar to the Guadalcanal fights, you know, again, this is so important. The American destroyers were told to hold their torpedoes, even though the Japanese were now visually sighted by the American task force. They could physically see them, not just on radar, but with the naked eye, they could see them. By the time any torpedo attack on the American side would commence, the surprise was long gone. The Japanese were way out of position in terms of any kind of successful chance of a torpedo strike. And he kind of he screws the pooch in this aspect right here.
He does. You know, we've talked about repeatedly the old Sun Tzu dictum to use your strength against the enemy's weaknesses. And it appears that Ainsworth believed that his strength was this machine gun cruiser capability that we had that he knew the Japanese didn't have. So I think he believed we would just overwhelm them with gunfire, which might have been possible, but that doesn't obviate the need to use those torpedoes while they're still useful. You know, again, the old saying that, you know, you sink a ship by letting the water in from below the waterline. And the thing that causes that to happen is a torpedo. And so he could have had his cake and eat it too if he would use his torpedoes first and then open up with those machine gun cruisers and overwhelm them with gunfire.
Exactly. And while he does sink Niizuki, and they do, he overestimates, Ainsworth overestimates the punch of the American gunfire. He believes he's set 3 or 4 Japanese destroyers on fire, and he has hit them. Be abundantly clear, he has hit them, but they are not sinking. The only one that is going down is Niizuki. By 0203, Ainsworth receives the surprise of his life when the Long Lances arrive to the party. In a span of 2 minutes, Helena absorbed 3 torpedo hits. Boom, boom, boom. First hit nearly blew her bow off, and the second hit nearly amidships holed her hull and caused her to immediately slow and list. A third hit just below her armor belt broke her keel, flooded the forward engine room and the boiler room's breech bulkheads, and flooded the aft engine room. It was clear that Helena was done for, and we'll get back to Helena's story in just a minute because it's rather amazing, but it's a sad ending to a very storied ship. You know, if you've listened to any of the Guadalcanal naval episodes that we've done, you hear Helena's name throughout, and she was a fine fighting vessel, and it's a really bad way for her to go down.
That's for sure. And of course, the American cruisers and destroyers are continuing to fire on the Japanese destroyers. They're now fleeing from the battlefield at nearly 30 knots. Ainsworth turned his force in such a way to cross the T. Remember from several battles ago, we talked about that. And the American spotters watched as flame and explosions sprouted on the decks and superstructures of the Japanese ships in column, which again reinforced the notion that we were inflicting more damage than we really were.
And this is kind of a strange thing here, because we've talked about American torpedoes, you know, being garbage. And we have an episode coming up here in another couple episodes where you really dig deep into the weeds of the American torpedo problem. But for most naval battles, our shells are be they 5-inch, 6-inch, 8-inch, 16-inch, whatever, they actually go boom when they hit a target. They are very, very reliable, whereas the Japanese shells were less so. Our shells are, you know, I don't know what the percentage rate is. I've seen a gentleman by the name of Nathan Oaken comment on our last few videos recently. This is a friend of John Parshall's. Nathan, if you're listening to this episode and you can lay it down on the percentage of American shells that actually go kaboom when they hit, I'd love to know it. But it had to be over 60%. I mean, it was a pretty significant amount. When we fired on something and hit it, shells usually explode. However, tonight is not the case. To your point, Bill, you know, the cruisers and the destroyers, specifically the cruisers, are hitting the Japanese. They're hitting them. But a lot of these shells are duds. And I mean, like a lot, like more than half that are hitting the Japanese destroyers. They're hitting them, but they're not exploding. You know, had they actually detonated like they were supposed to, this would have been an overwhelming American victory right here, because they were indeed hitting their targets. Ainsworth rightfully believed that he was doing damage to the Japanese, because he was. He just wasn't doing the damage that he should have been doing, because inexplicably the shells weren't going off like they were supposed to.
Now, there's a lot of potential causes for that. Of course, the easy one to blame is a defect in the detonator. That you just got a bad batch of detonators on these shells. That, you know, it also can be, remember that these shells for anti-armor shells are set with a delay. So impact, delay 5 millisecond, explode, so that the shell explodes inside the ship, not on contact with the armor or the superstructure. If you set that delay too long, and anytime I see a trend like a whole bunch of shells from a single ship aren't detonating, whereas other ships are, you can't help but blame that on operator error. And so if you set the delay too long, the shell's actually going to pass through the ship before it detonates. And I don't know what the right answer is. Maybe Nathan does, but there's a whole bunch of potential causes for this to happen.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, you're firing 6-inch, you know, a lot of 6-inch shells at a thinly armored destroyer. And, you know, as we'll see in other naval battles that occur, specifically Leyte Gulf Battle off Samoa, when big shells pass through a smaller target, weaker armored, they do tend to go right through the other side. And maybe that is what's happening here. I don't know. At 0235, American radar screens registered no targets in the area, because as you'll recall what Bill just said, the Japanese are getting the hell out of Dodge at about 30 knots. You know, they realize pretty quickly that they're under fire from a superior force, and they go, they open the throttles and they're like, we're gone, goodbye. And they peel out of there. But what they do, which sounded weird, but what they do accomplish is they go in there and they do disgorge their troops. They drop off about 1,600 of the 2,600 Japanese soldiers at their points of disembarkment, and then they bring them to where they need to be, and they leave them out there. So at this point, the Japanese mission is actually a success. The Americans sweep the area multiple times and find nothing on their radar scopes. Ainsworth detaches USS Nicholas and USS Radford to go and rescue Helena's survivors and lead the remainder of his task force back. And he leads the remainder of his task force back to Tulagi. Now, for all intents and purposes, Kula Gulf at this point is over, but we have to talk about the Helena episode, not only because we like the USS Helena, as we've demonstrated many times through episodes, but because this is a really cool story. Really is. When the first torpedo hits Helena, her bow was nearly shorn off. And I'm going to show the U.S. Navy damage report image of it here right now. And you'll see it. You see the huge hole that was carved into this thing by these long lances up on the bow. The movement of the ship forward through the water actually does tear the bow off. The second torpedo hit, as I said, penetrated her hull just below her second funnel. Her steam pressure immediately drops. Her lights fade. Then they go out with only emergency lamps piercing the darkness. Her engines would not answer. I mean, these, you know, John talked about these are ship eviscerators, these torpedoes. And that's exactly what they do to this light cruiser as they disembowel her with these three hits, particularly that second hit that's dead amidships. I mean, that just absolutely kills this thing. She's going down, Bill. What are the guys doing? I mean, this is a mad dash. You know, they're all hell's breaking loose here.
Trying to get out of the interior of the ship as quick as he can, because, you know, once the scuttles start flooding and water starts coming down the scuttles and ladders, you cannot fight your way past that water. The water is stronger than you are. So the first thing you do is try to get topside. You know, the order to abandon ship has been passed along. At this point, the 1MC probably didn't work. So the order to abandon ship has to be passed on by word of mouth, as happens so often during the war. And so they're coming up. They're grabbing their life jackets if they didn't already have them, because if they were near them during general quarters, some of them will likely have been wearing them during general quarters. And then, you know, they're going to be jumping overboard as quickly as they can. Men are going to be jumping on top of other men. It's going to be pandemonium. People, you know, kind of panics, you know, starts rearing its ugly head, because the steel is going to be ripping off of the hull plating. And you can hear that from below decks. You can hear that noise kind of reverberates throughout the ship, because the metal of the ship conducts that noise. So people are going to know, I only have minutes, maybe even seconds to live. So the captain, Charles Cecil, does order abandon ship as early as can be expected. And of course, when that second torpedo hits underneath this forward steam room, there's whole big oil bunkers in that steam room. So all of that oil pours out onto the ocean surface. It's covering the ocean surface. And we and people jump into the water. They're going to be coated with this oil. It's a black night. And then you're coated with this black oil. So you can't see each other except for the whites of your eyes. If you know, don't have oil in your eyes, it's terrible. And I believe that Captain Cecil was, in fact, the last man to leave the ship. Is that right, Seth?
That's what the report says, that he was indeed the last guy to leave the ship. Yeah, typical of, you know, U.S. Navy captains wanting to be the last man off the ship. You know, this is something that is not unprecedented, but he took it to heart. And by all reports, he was the last man that was alive to leave USS Helena. To your point, Bill, it is pandemonium. We've talked about guys getting off of ships, you know, here and there, like when Lexington was sunk. You know, it was a very orderly evacuation. There's other ships, the American ships that go down, that for the most part, they're very orderly evacuations. But when something like this happens in the middle of the night, in the middle of a battle, when your ship is literally disemboweled, there is no order here. It's every man for himself, mm-hmm. and you get the hell off of that thing. And that's exactly what is going on here.
Now, when the ship is at general quarters, the watertight doors should be shut. And so watertight compartments should help the ship float for a while. But once you've been holed, that water's getting into the hole. Doesn't matter how many watertight doors you have shut. Now, when the bow was broken off, assuming that at general quarters, the, you know, what we call condition zebra is Zed, I'm not sure what they would have called it on this ship, because there was no standard throughout the fleet. The bow might actually be watertight if it broke off as a complete whole piece. And if that's the case, then the bow might float even though the rest of the ship is sinking. And we have some evidence that happened here, I think, Seth, right?
Exactly right. And that is precisely what happens, is that Helena's bow actually, as we said, as she's going through the water, it does snap off and it floats and it becomes a refuge. A lot of the survivors see this thing. I mean, it's the bow of a cruiser, for crying out loud, sticking out of the water, and they make a beeline for it because it is floating. Guys are clinging to it. They're clustered around it. And it does serve as a beacon, if you will, for guys who are in the water, because it does stay afloat, and it stays afloat long enough for them to get pictures of it the following morning. They're not very clear, so I don't know how they'll look on the video, but if I can, I'll show them here. But it's literally, there's a bow just floating in the water right there. It's USS Helena's bow. At 0341, Radford and Nicholas slowly steamed into the area, into the horde of survivors. Nets are dangling over their sides. However, almost as soon as these two destroyers get in the area, they leave. They're gone because why? The Japanese return to the scene of battle. There's a radar contact that comes up on, I believe it's Nicholas's radar scope, that says, hey, you know, we got bad guys are back in the neighborhood here. The boogeyman's coming. We got to go. And there are, you know, accounts of American sailors hanging on to these nets that are dangling over the side of the destroyers. And they all of a sudden go for a ride because the DDs open up the throttle and they are gone. They're going to meet the Japanese. They're not running away. They're going to meet the Japanese threat. Guys are yelling over the side, we're coming back. Don't worry, we'll be back. And they indeed do come back. Later on in the morning, the Radford does come back, and the Nicholas do come back to get people out of the water. They have to break contact again because the Japanese are coming back into the area again. The Japanese come in and launch long-range torpedo strikes that don't hit anything. But again, there's still a threat, and these American destroyers have to take this into account, and they have to abandon the survivors for a little while they have to go meet that threat. In the morning, the Radford, as I said, does break off. They do wind up sighting the Japanese visually. They exchange gunfire and torpedoes at long range. Nothing really happens. The only thing that does happen is that the rescue is delayed and the Japanese are forced out of the area. They retire under a smoke screen. Nicholas and
so go ahead. Nicholas and Radford come back. They drop their motor whale boats and they start searching, picking people up. Now, remember, this is a cruiser we're talking about, the Helena. And cruisers have a very large crew. We're talking, you know, close to 1,000 sailors. And so there's a lot of people these two destroyers are trying to rescue. And, you know, finally, I think what happens is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't Admiral Ainsworth say, you guys have been out there too long. You need to, at dawn, you're going to be sighted. You need to come back. And or you're going to be attacked again. Is that what happens?
That's exactly what happens. Radford, Nicholas rescues 291 guys, just to be clear. Radford pulls another 444 guys out of the water. And to Bill's point, they did drop their motor whaleboats in the water. And that is exactly what happened. As dawn is not quite there yet, but it's pretty close. They get word from Ainsworth to say, essentially, get the hell out of there, because the threat of Japanese aerial attack is very, very real. And Ainsworth's already lost the cruiser Helena. He doesn't want to lose these two DDs as well. So Radford and Nicholas, they don't want to go, but they're under orders to go, and they do. They do pull out. Now, they, again, as I said, 291 guys and 444 guys rescued by those two destroyers is nothing small to sneeze at. They do leave their motor whaleboats in the water. And Captain Cecil, Helena's captain, he refuses to be rescued by the destroyers. And this guy's already won a place in my books as being pretty damn cool. Mm-hmm. Is that he refuses rescue by the destroyers, and he say, nah, if my guys are still in the water, then I'm staying here with them. So what he does, and this is really cool here, what he does is he opts to stay with his guys. He does climb into a motor whaleboat, and he takes command of this little whaleboat flotilla, and they decide, we're going to get the hell out of here under our own power. And that's exactly what they do. He's got three whaleboats, and they're all pulling a raft or two or three or four. And it's just this long column of little boats that are all Helena survivors. And they're just slowly making their way out of the area under power. It's
not quite Captain Bly stuff, going 1,000 miles in a sailboat, no, having to navigate. He's got land within sight. So,
right.
But it's still pretty spectacular that he does this and yeah, organizes the crew like this, and you know that he's within sight of them. So trying to get everybody that they can onto these, either a floating raft or an actual raft, a floating net, or into the motor whaleboat itself.
Yeah. And he does a good job. Like, they all do a good job. They sail all day long. And the little flotilla finally does reach a beach, which he believed, Cecil believed that it was closer to American lines than it actually was. He believed he was within 4 to 5 miles of American lines. He was actually about 7 miles away from American lines. Regardless, he's not terrible.
On Kolombagara, right?
Yeah. Yep. He's no, not on Kolombagara. He's I'm sorry. I just lost my place. Where the hell did I go?
That's okay.
Where did it go? Okay. So no, they weren't at Kolombagara. They were actually on New Georgia, but they were 7 miles away from American lines. They were near Kolombagara. That was the problem. They were within shell range of Kolombagara. So when they get there, it's too late to trek through the jungle. You know, some of these guys are wounded. Let's be abundantly clear. Some of these guys that are clinging to these nets or these rafts or on the whaleboats, more than likely on the whaleboats, are wounded. So he's like, we're not going to hump through the jungle in a place where we don't know where the hell we're going with a bunch of wounded guys. So they actually decide to sleep on the beach that night, all of them. They're striking out on the beach. The following morning, Ainsworth sends the destroyers Woodworth and Gwyn to go out there and look for the remainder of Helena's survivors. They arrive on the scene and spot the men on the beach. The men are sitting there basically waving, saying, hey, guys, we're over here. Come help us out. Cecil orders the whaleboats to be set afire. They do set the whaleboats afire. 88 men left. The 88 men that were left from the day before board USS Gwyn and return to Tulagi that afternoon. However, that is not the end of Helena's escapade, is it, Bill?
No, many of the men were still in the water, unfortunately, and several life rafts were still afloat. Men still clung to the bow that was still floating, the bow of the Helena, and were spotted by low-flying B-24s, and they were reported. And happy news, unlike the Juno, of course, this report actually gets where somebody can actually do something about it. So, but the men did begin to drift apart in the sea, as would happen, right? There's eddies and currents between these islands. The water spins in different directions. And some of them fashioned sails and headed towards Vella La Vella. Now, again, if I can go back to the map for a second, we're going to see what the heck are we talking about. Vella La Vella is way up here on the other side of Kolombagara. So these guys must have drifted up and around Kolombagara and see, well, if the current's taking me this way towards Vella La Vella, I might as well stay, you know, kind of swim with the current or sail with the current and aim for that itself.
And to be clear, Vella La Vella was not a place that these guys wanted to go. Vella La Vella was still firmly in Japanese hands. But when you got nothing to work with, you go where the current takes you, literally. And that's exactly what happens here. On July the 8th, natives on Vella La Vella aid the survivors and bring them to the local Coast Watcher station. So they do make it all the way to Vella La Vella. The Coast Watcher that's on the Vella La Vella, and I do not have his name currently, I'm sorry, I apologize about that, moved the men away from known Japanese positions and were hit, and he hid them in the island's interior. Groups of 50, groups of 11, and a further group of 104 were all spotted all over Vella La Vella by the natives. So, I mean, these guys are literally everywhere, all over the island. The Coast Watcher immediately contacts Guadalcanal, and immediately, within literally hours of getting this message, Richmond Kelly Turner says, we're going to go get him. He's not going to let these guys languish on Vella La Vella. For all Kelly Turner's issues that he had specifically at Savo Island and in later operations around Guadalcanal, he does eventually develop into a very, very fine commander. And this is, frankly, in my opinion, so far.
When he wasn't drinking.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. But this is so far his, in my opinion, his finest moment, because he spares nothing to go get these people. And he feels so indebted to them, frankly, that he exerts, you know, all his energy to make sure that this rescue does take place. The Allied plan calls for a rescue group of destroyers to penetrate near Vella La Vella, which, as I said, was still deep in Japanese territory. Two destroyer transports would be escorted by 8 destroyers. So, I mean, again, to my point, Kelly Turner's not, he's not holding back. He's sending 10 ships to go get these cats and get them the hell out of there. So what happens, Bill? What does, is the mission a success here?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is the men ashore somehow got word that Coast Watchers that there would be a rescue mission. And so they were on alert. And when they started seeing the American destroyers and APDs, the destroyer transports, show up, they were already on the beach, and they signaled by light. And so they had light signal to say, here we are. And by evening, the American Rescue Force was back at Tulagi, having pulled the remaining Helena survivors off of Vela La Vela back into Allied lines. So that was a remarkable rescue. And as I said, cruisers have a crew complement of 1,000. In this case, Helena had a crew of nearly 1,200. Mm-hmm. 168 men were lost, either during the battle or left adrift at sea, never seen again. 168 KIAs, they were the only American casualties of the Battle of Kula Gulf.
And, you know, to further put a little bow on what you were talking about, the rescue operation, not a single shot was fired in anger. So the American destroyers went in there, got their people, and got out. The Japanese had no earthly clue that we were ever there or we had ever been there. So it was a perfectly executed rescue operation. The final tally for Kula Gulf, you could honestly classify it as a draw, frankly. We lost 168 sailors that were aboard Helena that you just talked about, Bill. But we lost the Helena. You know, we lost a light cruiser, a very, very skilled, a battle-worn light cruiser. And the Japanese lost two destroyers. And I say two destroyers because we sunk the Izuki. Another destroyer actually ran aground and was scuttled by the Japanese, and they left it there. So it's counted as a loss. All of the destroyers in the Japanese force were damaged. They were all damaged in some way, shape, or form. While casualties for the Japanese were double the American casualties, the Japanese succeeded in delivering more than half of their human cargo ashore. So of the 2,600 people that they were bringing to the party, they actually delivered roughly about 1,600. So their mission to reinforce these positions was a success. Our mission to deny them that ability to reinforce these positions was a failure. So Kula Gulf, you know, you can look at it as a draw because, you know, the casualties were heavier on the Japanese, but they accomplished their mission, whereas we frankly did not, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the truth. And, you know, the destroyers, Radford and Nicholas, really shined during the rescue effort, and they were both awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for their efforts. You know, but again, it was a battle that could have easily been won. So a draw in my mind looks kind of like a loss when you lose a game that you should have won or lose a battle that you should have won. In the larger scheme, that's written up as a loss.
Yep. And what do they say? Is a tie is as good as a loss, and that's essentially exactly what happens here. Well, exactly what you were saying, Bill, it should have been an overwhelming American victory. We talked about the shells not going off. We talked about the screw up with the radar. We talked about the close confines of the water here. And we're going to revisit the close confines of these waters here in our next episode when we're talking about Kolomangara, the naval battle of, and Vela Gulf here too. But, it's a victory that should have been acquired that frankly was not. And you know, destroyers and cruisers, to your point, which you'd said earlier, this is really all we have to fight this fight with. And the listeners and the viewers are going to go, well, where the hell are the battleships and where the hell are the cruisers? If you think that Savo Island and the Iron Bottom Sound area was tight for battleships to maneuver in, and it is, again, refer to the map. This is even tighter than that. Battleships aren't going in there. Aircraft carriers, of which now we have several, this is not the appropriate place to deploy aircraft carriers. This is Torpedo Alley. This is Destroyer Alley. This close confines of these waters they're lining up for some significant destroyer action. And frankly, at this point, the destroyer war is just now beginning to heat up. Bill, do you have anything else you want to throw in here about Kula Golf?
No, we come out with two cruisers, the Honolulu Still Float as the St. Louis, and, you know, the destroyers, Nicholas O'Bannon, Jenkins and Radford. Of course, there were other destroyers that were involved in the recovery effort, rescue effort. And so, you know, what's going to happen here, I think, is that the conventional wisdom is going to be these waters are too tight, and we're going to see some destroyer action going forward. But as you said, we are not done with this little constrained area of water around New Georgia Islands, the collection of islands around the New Georgia archipelago.
Yep, absolutely. So while this is a relatively understated naval battle, it is important because it informs the next two events that we're going to talk about in next week's episode. We're going to combine two naval battles. We're going to talk about Vela Gulf and Naval Battle of Kolomangara next week. So basically, they're part two and three of this very event. So stand by. And with that, we want to thank you very much for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcast. Give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, tune into our YouTube channel called the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. Please do like our videos and subscribe to our channels as it helps other people find our show. If you have a question or a comment, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. So once again, I want to thank you very much. My name is Seth Paradin. Bill.
And I'm Bill Toady. Thank you, and see you again next week.